Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to sit in with you, not only on Saturday nights, but also on the second Sunday of each month. And once again, where it is still Sunday, the 10th, happy birthday to the U.S. Marine Corps. That's 238 years, and soon to be plus one day. And to those who are in the 11th day of November here in the United States, a happy and respectful Veterans Day as we pay homage to all branches of the service. Marines, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard. They're still military, aren't they? Are they attached to the Department of Homeland Security? I don't know. You may have heard the name Adam Kokesh. He was quite demonstrative in a patriotic act, which has made a little heat for him. So I wanted to bring him on the program. We've spoken with his media man, Jeffrey Phillips, a couple of times. And we're glad to know that he's able to be on the line with us. So why don't we just bring him on board the bridge of the mothership and talk with Adam Kokesh for just a few minutes. Adam, how are you?
Hey, outstanding, John. Thank you so much for having me on this evening. I really appreciate it. And I have to say, for all the coverage that you've given to my recent challenges, I greatly appreciate it. And in fact, when I was in jail, I was in jail for 3 months in solitary confinement, but I did make it to general population at the end there when you had my manager, Jeffrey Phillips, and my friend Anthony Antonello on. And while I was up in the middle of the night in my jail cell with my little transparent jail phone, I was able to catch a lot of that, and I'm so grateful that you helped spread the message and make a teachable moment out of what I did. And I was able to hear you read my letter to America on the air, and it really is reassuring that there are people out like you in the media who are willing to tell a story like this of someone who's challenging authority. And I just want to say, for everybody else who was a part of that effort in general of bringing attention to my case, I really, really appreciate it.
Well, Adam, here's the thing. I just thought, what is this young man up to? You're a veteran, yes?
United States Marine Corps, 6.5 years in a combat tour in Fallujah.
Now, we're at a delicate point in your situation. I am unclear on whether or not there's going to be a trial, or if there's already been one, and now we're looking at sentencing. I mean, so I don't want to get into anything that's going to, that would be indiscreet or would not, or in any way, cause a problem.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. If I may, I can explain the circumstance. And it is a delicate situation right now. It is tricky because I did plead guilty to certain charges in D.C. I'm still facing charges in Virginia, which is very frustrating. But I am going back for sentencing before Judge Broderick on January 17th. And she seems to be fair-minded, but, it is a delicate situation. And, I want to make sure that people know I'm taking responsibility for my actions. And, I don't want to make anybody feel threatened or uncomfortable in any way with anything that I've done. In my activism, I've always tried to make people think and challenge the way that people think about government. I think we accomplished that very well. But, any kind of civil disobedience has consequences, or it wouldn't be civil disobedience. So I did plead guilty, and it was the hardest decision I think I've ever had to make in my life. But when you're in jail, and like I said, I did my first 3 months in solitary confinement. And, I was in combat for 7 months. It's not, being in jail wasn't the challenge for me that I think it is for a lot of people. But the challenge for me really was the uncertainty. And when the government's throwing different things at you, and by this I specifically mean the prosecutor, and the conditions are changing all the time, it's a different kind of stress. I pride myself in being pretty level-headed and cool under fire, and I don't get stressed out. But it's dealing with that kind of uncertainty when you're in jail and you weren't expecting it, and you know you didn't hurt anybody, and you didn't commit any crimes of, that have victims. It's incredibly frustrating because you never know what someone who's motivated to, you know, put people in jail for victimless crimes is going to do to you. And but I do want to say on top of this that, you know, not just for everybody that supported me, but for what I learned while I was there, it was an incredibly humbling experience. And I was able to do some podcasts from jail through the jail phone, and my wonderful girlfriend, Carrie Wedler, who really stood behind me on this, would record my phone calls and then take the audio and put it up on our podcast stream and on YouTube. And I was able to get interviews with some of the inmates that are in there. And, you know, being able to present their stories, you know, I only did 4 months. And, yeah, when you're in jail for 4 months and 3 months of solitary, it can seem like forever. But there are guys who have been in for years who haven't been sentenced yet. You know, there are guys who have been in on false charges, completely false charges, who can prove it. There are people who are in who are guilty, who are trying to find justice. And instead, you know, we don't have a criminal justice system. We have a criminal punishment system. And it's not based on restitution. It's not based on making victims whole. It's based on punishing people. And a lot of guys are there, and they can accept their punishment. But it's really frustrating to see that when somebody goes to jail for a victimless or for a crime where they have a victim, and there are a lot of guys in there. You know, the cliche that everybody in jail is innocent. I only met one guy who was really just saying, oh, you know, I'm innocent and I can prove it and really, you know, screaming about that. Most of the guys in there are happy to take responsibility for their actions. But if they don't have a victim, or if they do have a victim, excuse me, if they've hurt somebody, you know, say they stole something, and then they go to jail for punishment, they go to jail for years, and what do? They live off of the taxpayer. And all the, you know, there's nothing expected of them. And it costs, you know, $130 to $150 a day to keep someone in jail. We have the highest prison population per capita in the world in America. And then the victim of this crime is doubly victimized as a taxpayer when they have to pay for someone to live with, you know, without being productive. And it's just, a term that I hope people can really grasp is Kafkaesque. For me, especially when I got to general population, when they say, you know, these are people who are so dangerous, they have to be isolated from society. But even for those of you who might be innocent, who are just being held pretrial, we're going to create this, you know, colony for you guys behind bars. It's insane. And I really hope that not just from my case, but in general, people take all of the lessons of this experience really as a teachable moment to see how far our government has gotten from a true concept of justice.
Adam, when were you actually released?
This Wednesday, and it was a total shock. It was after my plea, and I was absolutely ready to go back for 8 weeks at very least until sentencing, and I was expecting to, you know, possibly do a couple of years right after that. And there were a bunch of people in the courtroom that day who made their presence known in a very respectful way. You know, it's not always easy in a courtroom, but I think that really played in my favor. And for everybody that showed up last Wednesday in court, you know, I have to say thank you very much. And special shout out to Michael Salvi in Philadelphia for organizing that and getting people out. But this is the thing, when you have so much subjectivity in the justice system, all of the lobbying and everybody who wrote letters to the judge and left voicemails, it really does make a huge difference.
Adam, listen, I know you're tired. I can hear it in your voice, and you must be extraordinarily relieved, which sometimes the relief hits you as hard as the stress. But I implore you to let me do this little two-minute break and just stay with me just a few more minutes. I promise I won't drag you out for the whole hour.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, hang tough just a second, and we'll be right back with Adam Kokesh, libertarian activist. Adam Kokesh, I just want to just tread delicately here. I mean, we can say everything that needs to be said and not, not squash any toes anywhere. What was the point? What was the message that you were trying to send? Obviously, you know, this is a little weird. I got a couple of questions here. Were you in solitary confinement when you first got into the lockup for 3 months or two? I thought I heard you say both.
It was the first 3 months that I was locked up.
Well, my question is why do you suppose they would put you into solitary confinement like that? When you know, somebody who just shot somebody can bond out in, I don't know, a couple of days.
You know what I mean? In my case, the excuse was involuntary protective custody.
Involuntary protective custody. Okay.
Right.
And what does that mean? I understand the words, but I'm not sure what it means.
Yeah, I say because it's a high profile case, we're concerned that another inmate might have an interest in messing with you, so we have to protect you.
Okay.
And just so you know, like where I was when I first got to jail in D.C. was South 1 at the D.C. jail, and it really is an insane asylum. And half the crazies there are guards. But it was where they're trying to protect me, supposedly, but I have to get a strip search every time I leave my cell in shackles to walk 20 feet down the hall to take a shower. It really, there's just so much insanity of this, and of course not being able to sleep, but there's guards yelling at inmates, at each other. There's inmates that are literally insane that are up yelling all night, and it was just an otherworldly experience. But I got used to sleeping through mortars in Fallujah, so dealing with the conditions themselves was not the challenge. Really, the challenge was dealing with the stress of everything else. And this is just another thing I came to appreciate about people that are going through this. And I think a lot of times, if you haven't been arrested, if you've never gone to jail, and before this, the most time I'd ever done was 1 week in the feds in Philly. And this was, I'm sure you know the story, but just for the listeners, when I was arrested for giving a speech at a rally, and they tried to get me for assaulting a federal officer, and we challenged them, and we had the most clearly exonerating video footage. But for a week, it's sort of like, could you disappear from your life for a week without things kind of falling apart? And in my case, it was my home was raided, where I had a bunch of housemates. My home was turned inside out. I had property destroyed. I had property stolen. My studio was ransacked. And, I found out that money was being stolen while I was in jail, that people were lying in my name to the public about what was going on in order to alienate my supporters. It was, and that's what's really maddening. And now I'm gotten out. And the reason I'm tired right now, and the reason that things have been so frustrating just in the last few days since I've been out, is that I'm trying to put my life back together. I've been going to my storage unit, where everything has just been an incredible mess. And it's like I went from having a life where I was, really centered around doing my podcast and working on my YouTube channel. And for people that don't know, youtube.com/AdamKokesh, KOKESH. Still got a lot of great videos up, and there's still a few coming from some podcasts from when I was in jail. And then all of a sudden, I'm in jail, and I come out, and I've seen it just fall apart one piece after another. And I understand that there are people who are working for me that are very courageous in taking the risk just of living in the same location as me. And when you go through something like this, I mean, I was taking a nap when this happened, and the police knocked on the door, and they're supposed to give you a few seconds to answer, right? No such luck. They break it down with a battering ram. My dog is, in right in front of the door because he's curious about the noise. I come to the top of the stairs just in time to see the door get bashed in and a flashbang grenade go off right next to my dog. And I'm in a sense, I'm really glad that it happened this way physically because, in these situations, cops have a really bad habit of shooting dogs. And he ended up running scared up into his crate and probably saved his life that way. But I had two green laser sights on my chest, and then I was zip-tied and sitting on the floor in my kitchen for 5 hours while I'm watching the cops going, ransack my home. And that was how this whole thing started for me. So for my housemates, they were all forced to sit there for for 5 hours. My girlfriend was, if I may, on her period at the time and pulled out of the shower and forced to sit in her own blood for hours before she was able to address that. And then I get taken away, and all these people who depend on me holding the operation together are, you know, sitting there in this pool of trauma going, well, what do we do now? And to the credit of most of them, they were able to keep a lot of stuff going. But, I mean, you can imagine when something like this happens, really out of the blue. And to be fair, I would not have been surprised if I was served a warrant. I would not have been surprised if I was arrested and detained and released on bail and faced, you know, all the same legal consequences. But for it to happen like this is a really clear case of political persecution. And you might not know, but this is a pattern with the United States Park Police and myself. Every time an officer gets featured in one of my videos, even if you go back to the Jefferson Dance Party in 2011, when I was dancing in protest and I was picked up and body slammed, choke slammed, and kneed in the ribs, it was an officer that just so happened to be featured in a video 3 weeks prior. When the officer tried to tackle me in Philly, it was a guy that was featured in the video from a month prior. When I got arrested in front of the White House and they handcuffed me from behind, and then instead of picking me up by the office, picked me up by the hand, it was an officer that a few months earlier had been featured in a video. So all of this pattern of retaliation kind of came to a head with this raid. But when you have law enforcement that can get away with this kind of stuff, and I know you're familiar, and your audience, I'm sure, is familiar with all of the various challenges of living in a police state, but this sort of arbitrary authority has a real chilling effect that makes it harder for people to speak out. But I would just hope that, you know, and I think in large part, thanks to people like you, hearing a story like mine has the reverse effect of what they want it to have. And while there is some chilling effect and there is some fear that is very legitimate when you see something like this happen, that more people are motivated to speak out and do something and stand up for justice.
Yeah, country's come a long way from couple of cops come up the door and go, okay, come here. To, you know, four guys standing there with AR-15s or M4s or whatever, you know, pointed at your head while you're zip-tied.
It was a helicopter, an armored vehicle, half a dozen cruisers, half a dozen unmarked vehicles, and at least 30 officers at one point or another that actually came into my house, including plainclothes detectives, uniformed SWAT team members wearing ski masks, regular street patrol uniform officers, and plainclothes officers wearing ski masks.
Oh, is that all? I mean, no aircraft carrier?
I think they had to switch out the helicopters at one point.
Man, that's just unbelievable. It really is. I don't... look, here's the thing. Irrespective of how this may have come across, it was, in fact, a victimless incident. And I don't understand the overwhelming police force. I mean, how much of a statement do you need to make on an individual? And I think it sounds you're completely correct, and I certainly don't want to pour salt in the wound. But yeah, it's just a little bit that's a little bit too much. That's like using a huge quarry grade front loader on a little anthill. It's just stupid.
I don't have to play up my story in this because there are people in America who have experienced far worse. You know, I'm grateful I didn't get shot. I'm grateful my dog didn't get shot. I'm grateful no one got seriously hurt. I did get kicked in the face at one point during this ordeal. Not anything major. It was more, you know, I don't want to make a big deal out of this because there are people who have experienced far worse. But what does it say when the United States government sends more men after activists than they sent after bin Laden?
You know, that's an extraordinarily good point. What's the next step? What's your next date with the authorities?
Well, I'm going back for the charges that I'm facing in Virginia on December 16th, and We're still not sure what we're facing here. And then sentencing in D.C. on January 17th. And I hope that people will stand by me in all this. I hope that people will be there on January 17th in court. And, you know, I'm looking to get this resolved as quick as possible and get back to my regular production. I'm looking forward to writing a book over the next 10 weeks, spending a lot of time with my family. And, you know, I hate to say it, but generally laying low and, you know, being as respectful as I can for the time being. And, you know, they really do, you know, until you've gone through this, you really can't appreciate all the way they get their hooks in you.
Hang on. Adam, thank you very much for agreeing to stay around for the rest of the hour. That's excellent of you. Kay fired off an email a while ago, and it's a really good one. Kay says, ask Adam if he finds a contrast between the arrest with a flashbang grenade versus how Aaron Hernandez, who's accused of murdering his friend, and how the police in plainclothes very politely knocked on his door and waited for 10 minutes for him to open the door. Then they politely arrest him without any handcuffs, a murder suspect. I really wanted to talk to you tonight because, I don't want to go into any areas that are going to make anything worse. I mean, frankly, I think everybody's made their point. And, but, I mean, what does it say when people, well, it's like another guest on the program said, when did the American people become the enemy of the state to the point where they're, you know, the force of the state comes against an individual, not just a couple of police officers going, listen, come on, you got to go with us. There's a problem. But the helicopter and the armored vehicle and laser gun sights all over you and all of that. I mean, you're not saying it. I'm saying it. I just think that's just a little bit much. And, you know, as more and more constitutional rights are violated, and they are increasingly violated. In fact, it's becoming monotonous. What does it say about what our civilization, our society has come to? These things weren't, back in the old days, if one police car was by your house, it's like all the neighbors were going, what's going on over there? Because you just didn't see them. And now it's cameras everywhere and police officers everywhere and all these reports of some of them just really going across the line, which of course makes the entire establishment look bad. It's the old one bad apple wreck the barrel. So give us a little insight into just some of the observations that you made while you were in a position to do so as to, I mean, you were talking about people, you know, you got crazy ones in there that are clearly, at least would be, in my opinion, a good candidate for some medication, screaming all night and stuff like this. And, you know, guards screaming at each other and all of that. What is this? Just a big business and a big show? I mean, is there? I think really you already covered this question. There's not really a justice system. It's more of a criminal justice system. It's like a criminal punishment system. But unfortunately, the ones who do the arresting are often the judge and jury and are meeting out the punishment before you even get to trial.
Well, John, I'm really glad that people are taking this as a teachable moment and that it's stimulating these kinds of questions and this line of thinking. But the answer to your question really lies in the way that you asked it. Are the people now the enemy of the government? What does that mean? That the government takes advantage of the people? That the government doesn't respect the rights of the people? Has it ever been anything other than that? Is it perhaps inherent to the very nature of government as a monopoly on the initiation of force in an arbitrary geographical area that has made the relationship this way? Is it possible that because government is a racket, in a sense that you phrase the question, that people have always been the enemy of the abusers, the exploiters that are government? Is it possible that when you say they're always violating our constitutional rights, that just in that use of the language, you are revealing the truth here, and that it's not constitutional rights. Our rights don't come from a document that gives power to the existence of this racket of government in the first place. Our rights are inherent. And the fact that we identify our rights not based on what we feel is simply our natural state as human beings, but the privileges granted to us by government, really shows how bad a racket this is, how deeply ingrained in our psychology this is. The fact that we refer to ourselves as Americans, as a collective, rather than as individual human beings, and we see ourselves identified not by who we are in our nature, but rather what particular racket we are born into. And this has been described as political Stockholm syndrome, where we have come to love our captors. And in that sense, it's really falling apart now, but because that kind of psychological dependence is so absolutely essential to keeping this racket going. But this is where a libertarian understanding of what government is so essential and so illuminating, because you don't just ask these questions and then go away frustrated. You can actually answer those kinds of questions with an understanding of what's really going on. And when you ask, what is government? It is nothing more than a group of people with a quasi-socially granted monopoly on the initiation of force in their territory. It's a protection racket. If you believe in the free market and you understand that that's not about corporations, that's about peaceful exchanges between individuals, and you understand that government is force, that government is coercion, that everything the government does is essentially backed up by the barrel of the gun, you no longer are surprised when things like this happen. It becomes a natural course of events when you allow a group of people to have this kind of arbitrary power over others. That I see right now, and of course this is essential to my work and what motivates me and spreading my message and waking people up, is that people are getting this. People are more empowered than ever before because of shows like yours, because of the information available on the internet, because people can do the research for themselves and find out what's really going on. People are waking up like never before. I believe that humanity is evolving, at very least in the social sense, where we are becoming less dependent on these mechanisms of force, that we are finding out that we can solve all these social problems voluntarily through peaceful interactions. And there is nothing that humanity has ever been able to accomplish by force that we won't be able to do better through peaceful cooperation. That's the paradigm shift that I see going on right now. It's the libertarian paradigm shift that's happening. And it's a very, very exciting time to be alive as we are coming to what I can only describe as the asymptote of human existence, as so many exponential growth curves get to the point where, of course, I know they don't technically ever go vertical, but to the purpose of human lives in terms of our perception, when it comes to life expectancy and computing power and technology and productivity, we are coming to the point where humans will never be tempted again to rely on things like government, like force and violence and coercion to solve social problems. And we're already living in the most peaceful time in human existence, in the sense that you as an individual are least likely to be subject to violence by another person. We've come a long way, and it's a beautiful thing. And while we have institutionalized force in government getting out of control, at the same time, there are these overriding dynamics. Maybe it's two steps forward, and we're in the middle of a major step backwards right now, but we're about to come to a great step forward in human progress for liberty.
That's fantastic. Nick, did I take that break or did I not? We're going to take a break. We're going to take a two-minute break and come right back with Adam Kokesh. Okay, everybody, just hold your position. Anybody who is on hold for open lines, we're going to get to that at the top of the hour, so you might as well stay where you are. You've waited this long, and we'll talk to you. This is the Sunday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. We're visiting tonight with Adam Kokesh, and Adam, if I ask you any questions that you don't want to get into, all you got to say is, and I'll go, okay, and we'll move on, okay? Because I don't want to cause any problems. I just want to, I'd like to solve some. I'd just like to solve some, you know? Now, you're a veteran, and it has been brought with quite great frequency in various channels of, it's one channel, it's the internet, but various sources on the internet, that returning veterans are regarded as a potential threat to the government. Are you picking up any of that? And do you think maybe...
Absolutely.
Okay.
No, absolutely. And, you know, when you take the people that are most willing to put their lives on the line for what they believe in, and you abuse them, and you take advantage of them, and you use them up and spit them out like you don't care about them, but they're all trained to kill, and they're all very passionate, and they come home from wars that they find out are a racket, you got a big problem on your hands if you're one of the racketeers. And I'm a big fan of Major General Smedley Butler. And when I went through boot camp with the United States Marine Corps recruit training out of MCRD San Diego, you learn about Smedley Butler. But all they teach you is about his military exploits and how he's one of the most decorated Marines in military history with two medals of honor and all the other awards. He fought in World War I and all the banana wars. But what they don't teach you about in boot camp is how he came home after that and wrote a book called War is a Racket, in which he described himself as a high-class muscle man for big business. And he was unique in his time for being able to figure it out in an age of limited information when propaganda had a much greater effect. And now that we have the great counter-propaganda tool of the internet that you mentioned, the guys that come home are able to figure this out much more quickly. And there is an incredible movement of veterans. And I see so many in my audience, in my fan base of guys and gals especially, who come back and go, what the heck just happened? What were we fighting for? And my cousin died from wounds suffered in Iraq. And I saw Marines die when I was in Fallujah. And I have a tattoo. I have a memorial tattoo with a helmet and a rifle. And it says, some gave all for nothing. And it's not easy to accept. And you see a real divergence here. You know, you see the kind of veterans who go on with their lives and bury their heads in the sand, and they love it when they hear, you know, the smoke being blown about veterans serving their country, and they know it's all a sham. And you know it's those guys that have been through this, that have been through these experiences, that have seen the wastefulness, that have seen the fraud, the abuse that is so throughout all of our current military adventurism. They see that you know, when they see their buddies having died, it's really hard to face up to the fact that they died for nothing, that they died for less than nothing, that they died for a racket, that they died for profit, that they died for war being the health of the state, because the politicians know that a country at war is going to have a rally around the leader effect. And a lot of guys who do that, you know, will crawl into bottles and destroy their lives, or this false patriotism, and they'll live in that frustration for until the day they die, and they'll be miserable. And then you have the guys that are really grappling with this. You know, sometimes that's where you see the substance abuse. And of course, alcohol is the worst substance to be abusing. But then there's the other category, people that have come to peace with this. And most of us who have become warriors for truth, become passionate about fighting for real justice. And that's the threat, is that we're veterans who have worked for the government that are going to come home and tell the truth. And so there's this big push, you know, and I can tell you this from my personal experience. I went to the VA and told them I was having trouble sleeping, and I've dealt with PTSD. And they gave me 5 prescriptions, 3 of which had suicide as a side effect. Veteran suicide is not an issue that the people behind the scenes didn't know was going to be a problem. It's all part of the calculated racket. And they are more than happy to keep guys in that state of either denial or of grappling with these issues or of struggling with PTSD, because the last thing they want is for the guys that were the greatest victims and victimizers of the racket at the same time to come home and tell the truth.
I'm sure you must have picked up some of this along the way. You're going to have somebody that says, Adam Kokesh is an anarchist. Well, let's get our definition straight. Anarchy is a state of disorder due to absence or non-recognition of authority. You know, also lawlessness or nihilism, mobocracy.
Well, hold on a second. If I may, right there, there's an inherent contradiction. And the language is designed to make you think that authority, that as humans having rule over each other, is essential for order. And that if we don't have people in charge of us, there's going to be disorder. And the opposite is what's true. The more we give up our sovereignty as individuals to authority, the more we have the chaos and disorder of what we have today as a result of government. Now, anarchy is a word that's been maligned. But you look at the root of it. It's not no rules. It's no rulers. It's self-government. It's about ruling your own life. And it's got the double meaning of chaos and disorder. But that's the trick, because if anything, chaos and disorder comes from rulers and authority that's out of control. That's what we have today.
Every time, yeah. You know, I got a question that's been dogging me for years, and it is this. What are we doing over there in the Middle East? Seriously, we've been over there for 10 years. What are we doing there?
The government will fill every opportunity provided by circumstance to take advantage of people. And you know, even with as horrific as this is, and I you know, I go back to the first Gulf War for the great statistic of 500,000 Iraqi children died from sanctions, from lack of access to adequate nutrition and medical care. But you look at the numbers, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of victims of this phase of the global war on terror. And if anything, it is an incredible measure of the humility and forgiveness of the Muslim world, of the Arab world in general, that there hasn't been more real terrorism in the United States, that most of what we've dealt with has been contrived.
Well, that pretty much says it all, doesn't it? Because, I mean, you're not the only one thinking this, and you're not the only one saying it. It's just not being said loud enough. I'm just wondering how long we're going to stay over there. I understand that every place that we've been into that we're now leaving, the violence just ramps up big time the moment that we start to leave. I'm wondering what was accomplished here.
Well, part of the problem with government as an institution is that it serves as a very efficient mechanism of distributing and obscuring responsibility. And you've heard the argument, I was just following orders, right? And it didn't fly at Nuremberg, and it doesn't fly today for anybody with a conscience. And if anything, I feel like what I'm doing with my activism now is a kind of penance for my participation in the United States military. And I want to say to all the people who are still in the military right now who know that what I'm saying is true, is that you can apply for conscientious objector status. You can get out when your contract is up. You don't have to re-up. You don't have to be dependent on this. And a lot of people will say, well, and I heard this from guards when I was in jail too, well, I'm just doing this because I got to take care of my family. Really? You're selling your soul to government? Really? You're taking a paycheck to do immoral things, to be a part of the system in order to take care of your family, and you're coming home with that kind of energy to your kids, and you're creating that kind of world for them where they're going to face the same lack of options because you didn't have the guts to stand up for what is right and what is just. You didn't have the guts to stand up and say, I'm going to do the right thing. Instead, you cowered behind saying, I'm just doing my job or I'm just getting a paycheck, because that's part of the problem. We need to stand up and realize the implications of our actions and understand that actions have consequences and that there is no escaping culpability because you are just following orders or because that's the law. Because some politician wrote it down on a piece of paper and voted for it, that's not an excuse. And I think the more people realize that and start living by these values of nonviolence, at least of non-aggression, the sooner we're going to create the kind of world that humanity is destined to achieve, of a voluntary, stateless, peaceful, harmonious, by one definition, anarchist, voluntary, stateless society. But it's coming, with or without you. One way or another, I firmly believe that humanity marches on. This is the destiny of the species, and because if for nothing else than what I believe is a fundamental force of nature, that cooperative relationships are superior to coercive or violent relationships, they are going to come to be the dominant paradigm because they will succeed where violence and aggression fails. So, ultimately, it comes down to people as individuals. And, you know, in America, we take this phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as a kind of succession, but I think it's backwards. And this was one of the major epiphanies that I had when I was in jail, is that liberty doesn't allow you to pursue happiness. Happiness isn't something you beat over the head with a club and drag home to enjoy forever and ever. Happiness is a choice, and happiness causes liberty. And a truly happy person doesn't resent their oppressors. A truly happy person is never going to dwell or live in anger. A truly happy, centered person will look upon this problem and say, how could I possibly let someone suffer and continue to be in pain to such an extent that they have to violate the rights of others? How could I possibly not share the joy of living that I experienced with them? How could I possibly go on and see them suffer when I could be empowering them? And that's the real important part about what I want to bring to people, is that message of fundamental empowerment, that you can choose to be happy. You can choose to live your life by your values, by the way that you want to live them. And if your happiness is dependent on external factors, you're an emotional slave.
We got to go, Adam. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. We're going to keep up with you and monitor your progress through this ordeal.